Good morning. It's great to be with you here this morning. As many of you know, and you do now, that I spent almost 3 weeks this past July traveling in Kenya. While the tour did include 3 days on safari in Samburu National Park, the rest of the trip was billed as a woman-to-woman cultural experience, including visits to schools, clinics, orphanages, and workshops to meet people, mostly women, who were truly making a difference. When I explained this to folks before the trips, some exclaimed, "Why would you want to do that when there's all that wildlife there to see?" Or, "We have plenty of these institutions right here in the U.S. Why go to Africa to see them?" Even though others didn't say these things out loud, you could read this reaction on their faces and by the way they quickly changed the subject. But maybe some were just uncomfortable with the idea of seeing these things at all. While I was game for the experience, I really had no idea of what would be happening or how I would react. Mainly, I was just open to finding out. Intellectually, I knew that Kenya was hard hit by the AIDS epidemic and that Kenya's history of colonialism and strife, both before and following independence from the British, had created a culture that was very complex and contradictory. Further, I understood that even the poorest people in the U.S. might seem privileged compared to the typical Kenyan. Only about 10% of Kenyans, 46 million people, are middle or upper class. But this figure is growing, as is the economy. The entire GDP would rank just behind the state of Idaho. Half the country is engaged in agriculture. I traveled with a group of 6 other women, plus our tour director and her husband, Linda and Paul Higdon, who are visiting us today. Paul took care of most of the logistics and lectured us on Kenyan history and economics to help us put what we would see in perspective. Although no one had met anyone else beforehand, and we were from different cities across the U.S., the group bonded instantly. No surprise there, as we were all on this tour for pretty much the same reasons. But the support and understanding of the group was key in helping each other to process our experiences. Each evening, either before or after dinner, we held a circle with identical guidelines to our own sacred circles. Yes, Linda has some experience of UUism. I am now going to tell you about just one of the remarkable and visionary people I met, and some of the experiences that were most meaningful to me. There were many more, and I could use 20 minutes on each one of them. For instance, this book chronicles the work of another truly visionary couple. A Kenyan street boy wed to an American woman who have accomplished incredible things in a Nairobi slum, one of the largest in the world. Certainly, we have many remarkable people right here at UUFSD and in the local community, but the stories I will relate are from a different culture, and as such, they helped me to better understand my own. In 2001, Mercy Chidi Ogbana and her husband came to the U.S. on a trip to raise money to fund a program for grandmothers raising their grandchildren in the wake of the AIDS epidemic. By chance, they met Linda, who had connections, and that in 2003 led to the successful funding of work to assist these families and provide HIV testing and education on safe sexual practices throughout the city of Meru. As the epidemic waned, the focus morphed into a home for AIDS orphans, funded by further grants and donations. Today, it takes in abandoned babies, only a few of whom are HIV positive. Right now, there are about 35 babies from 2 months to 6 years being cared for by 3 shifts of 5 very loving nannies in what is called the New Start Center. Our group got to spend the day bathing, changing, and feeding and playing with the littlest ones and helping the older ones with their homework when they got home from school. Such joy. But that's a story for another day. Back to Mercy. Next, she opened on another secure site, a shelter for defiled girls, aged 12 to 17. The perpetrator was most often a male relative. Many of the girls we met had babies and small children, and some were pregnant. They receive health and psychological care while at the shelter under the supervision of social worker house mothers. We spent time with the girls in pairs and as a group singing and dancing. They felt relaxed in their safe environment, but of course many missed their families. The social workers endeavor to find a relative to take them in, or if the abuser is removed, they can return home. But many stay at the center for a long time. To keep these facilities, collectively called Ripples International, and her other work, including a health clinic in Meru, sustainable, Mercy started an exclusive private elementary school on the New Start property, catering to the well-off in Meru. With the tuition paid by these families, she can mostly fund her other projects, and the children from the orphanage and of the defiled teen mothers attend free. Well, she didn't stop there. Mercy was active in a national movement for establishing women's circles throughout the village in the region of Meru. More on that later. Sadly, Mercy's first husband died, and after several years, she met and married a man from Ghana, John Burke Bayadu, who happened to be a human rights lawyer. Mercy and John decided to sue the government for failing to enforce the existing laws in Kenya against defilement of girls and women, and of failing to prosecute the perpetrators. They gathered the stories of 160 defiled girls and filed suit. Eventually, the Supreme Court found in their favor. With the settlement funds, they both compensated the victims and initiated a program to train police forces throughout the country and how to deal with defilement cases. Convicted perpetrators are now serving 15 to 30 year jail sentences, and it is expected that defilement will diminish in the future. Now, about the women's circles. In the past couple of decades, these represent a cultural shift that has brought about some empowerment of women beyond their traditional customs, which I'll describe in a minute. The women meet regularly in community, often with a social worker facilitator until a leader emerges from amongst the participants. They discuss common problems and solutions. Also, they engage in table banking, a form of microfinance. The women put a small amount of cash on the table each month. Then they take turns using this sum of money, likely more than they could save up from themselves, for a purpose that will advance their family. For example, one woman purchased chickens, which have over time reproduced, to provide eggs and meat for the family, to trade with neighbors, and to sell at market. Meeting these women's circles was an important part of our group's activities. It gave us the chance to find out about their lives and share something of ours. When the women, dressed in their colorful finest, would see us coming, they would begin to sing and dance. As we climbed out of the vans, they invited us to join in the revelry. After 30 or so minutes of this, the ice was well and truly broken. Many spoke some English, but we always had an interpreter with us to facilitate as needed. Next, we shared a meal that had been prepared by the women over an open fire from produce harvested in the adjacent fields that morning. Truly delicious and probably the healthiest food I've ever eaten. Finally, we sat on the hard ground and asked and answered each other's questions about our respective ways of doing things. We shared the rhythm of a typical day in our lives as working women and mothers. A village woman's typical day begins around 4 a.m. when she gets up to feed the livestock, fetch water from afar, prepare breakfast for the family, get the kids off to school, work in the fields until the children arrive home for lunch, feed them, then do laundry and other household chores until the animals need tending again, and the kids arrive home from school for the day around 4 p.m. Then there would be the evening meal and homework supervision, with bedtime for all around 8 p.m. Generally, much of the field work and chores were shared with adult women relatives and neighbors, with much socialization and community throughout the day. In contrast, I got to tell them about my typical day. I would get up around 6 a.m., feed the kids, pack their lunches, drive them to daycare or school, go to work, pick the kids up around 5:30 p.m., drive home, fix dinner, supervise homework, and tend to the bedtime ritual around 8. Then I had a couple of hours to relax or catch up on chores before retiring for the evening at around 10:30 p.m. Except for the time at work, I did all this pretty much on my own. You may be wondering what the husbands were doing all this time. Well, mine was gone. In Kenya, jobs are scarce, so the husbands are off to the local pub for a day of carousing with their buddies. Some men manage to find occasional work to earn cash that generally goes to drink, but they are also expected to pay the children's school fees. However, most of the family's cash is derived from the women selling their field produce on market day in the nearest town, or from their ventures funded by the table banking. Interestingly, in recent years, due to the empowerment of their wives by the women's circles, some men have been energized to earn more money. We saw men drive livestock to the fields, which has become necessary since the children who used to do this are now attending school. Progress. At the close of our meetings with the village women, Linda would ask the women whether they would like to swap places with us. They emphatically shook their head no. They love their lives in the community of their villages. They considered this far more rewarding than a life with material goods, but tending to social isolation. They were genuinely happy and content, laughing and smiling most of the time. One woman asked, "With all the wealth in your country, why are you not kinder to one another?" No one had an answer. We also visited or spoke with amazing folks who had founded facilities that take in street children from the slums, mostly boys. I will describe just one very briefly. The founder grew up in a home headed by a preacher father and with an adopted young brother who had been formerly a street child. Like many PKs, he chafed at having to behave properly all the time. His form of rebellion was to bully other kids. His adopted brother was a favorite target, and the poor kid was afraid to complain because he feared he might end up back on the streets. Finally, a parent at the school the bully attended complained to the principal and insisted that the bully be brought forth to hear about the havoc he had caused in the life of this man's son. The bully had no idea of the damage his behavior had caused. And from that day on, he ceased his bullying. He grew up and together with his street boy younger brother, started a home for street boys that we visited. It was a very basic operation, but certainly infinitely better than the streets. The 34 boys living there were lively, happy, and totally engaging. All attended a nearby school and had great ambitions for the future. The total budget for this facility was $36,000 a year. I mention this because so much can be done in Kenya with so little. To get a picture of how things are changing in Kenya, two other topics need brief mention: Pentecostalism and tribalism. There seems to be a church on every street corner, and with wonderful music emanating from each on the Sunday morning that we set out to attend one with a special connection to Linda. I asked why so many, and the answer was that each of the tribes in the region, 44 in all of Kenya, have their own church. We were told that before the British colonial occupation, there was very little interaction or discord amongst the tribes, but that the British created conflict among them to better control the population. Unfortunately, tribalism rules current politics, and the recent election problems stem from this issue. In recent decades, Pentecostalism has evolved on top of traditional spiritual practices and retains the emphasis on community and a personal relationship with that which is greater than oneself, previously the ancestors, and now God. It is more emotional than traditional Christianity and fosters hope for a future of health, success, and prosperity. This resonates deeply with the Kenyans. A banner in the church we attended proclaimed the church's vision, mission, and values. I quote, vision, to be a kingdom-minded people that impact the world for Christ. Mission, we exist to be witnesses of Christ, make multiplying disciples, incorporate them into God's family, and equip them for worship and service. Core values, family, integrity, accountability, team ministry, and stewardship. Once you get over the Christ talk, I think that most of us would resonate with these aspirations. This church also welcomed people from all tribes. And the music director, Esther Mababu, whose home we visited that Sunday afternoon for tea, mentioned that the church's community outreach involvement involved sex education for children and teens. The program she described sounded a lot like our OWL program, with its emphasis on information, communication, and responsible choices. The church can also be credited in part for the decline in child marriage, polygamy, female genital mutilation, and the shunning of unmarried mothers. Regarding Esther, she nearly has completed a sociology PhD with her thesis topic, Melding the Best of Traditional Values into the Promises of Modern Life. So what did I take from this exceedingly rich experience? First and foremost, an appreciation of how such a different culture can please me in so many ways. The beautiful faces full of light and hope, despite what we would consider abject poverty. The power of the women to do such demanding work with such grace and love. The connected community of relatives and friends always there to offer companionship, love, and support. Music and dancing everywhere. Vibrant commerce on the slum streets. I concluded that the Kenyan people really know what living is all about. Further, meeting the people I just described and so many others, and learning of their energy, creativity, and dedication to improving the lives of their fellow citizens was incredibly inspiring. It affirms in me that indeed, service is our prayer. They said it, if not me, then who? I must do what I can. One person can do so much. So what can I do? Well, I'm no visionary, and at 75 must recognize that my energy level will not be sustainable forever. But this I can do. I'm standing here telling you about it, and I'm ready and willing to address other groups in hopes of inspiring people who might come to listen. I would love to have a Friday potluck to show some of my photos, describe other experiences not mentioned here, and to give you the chance to ask questions as you would like. I'm sure you have many. I've barely scratched the surface. I may have already saved my grandsons from growing up spoiled rotten, but that's another story. Also, I'm thinking, and have made a modest start, of collecting stories, not just from Kenya, but from wherever they originate, of people who experience an epiphany that turned them from a life of self-involvement to one of outreach to their fellow human beings. The story of the bully will be included. These I shall call stories of the awakening heart. If any of you have some you would like to share with me, I would gladly listen. Will I provide money? Yes. While I regularly contribute to the UU Service Committee, Doctors Without Borders, UNICEF, and Refugee Relief, I feel it is important to do more on a personal level. Specifically, I have sponsored a child in one of the homes for street children. I plan to donate to the Bully's Home for Street Kids, as their budget did not allow for the 50% increase in food costs due to the current severe drought conditions in Kenya, believed to result from global warming. More specific needs will present themselves as I plan to stay in touch with my fellow travelers and Linda and Paul. Finally, I hope to be more involved with the social action project sponsored by our committee here at the Fellowship. While I have often been a participant, I would like to be more involved in the planning and leadership. Thank you all for listening, and let us converse more about these experiences and their impact. After you get your coffee, please join Linda, Paul, and me in Founders Hall to view Linda's award-winning documentary, beauty in the unexpected. I just saw it between services, and it really, truly is a lovely short film, and you'll well worth your time. So thank you, and we'll see you up there.